Hey there, M Critters. This is the M Crit Podcast. My name is Scott Weingart. I am sorry today's episode is late. I was actually in Canada for 4 days. I first visited the folks from UHN in Toronto, had an amazing time, and then swung over to London, Ontario, and was given the royal treatment over there. I had such a good time. But the field recording setup I had, I planned to record during the trip itself. The sound quality was less than perfect, so I figured I'd just wait, come home, and record when I got here. So what I figured I'd talk about today is the management of severe hemorrhage from mid-facial trauma. And usually this is going to be from blunt trauma. I think the best way to talk about this is by using a case. So this case occurred at Janus General. I was the ED critical care guy on shift, and a patient rolled in after a motorcycle crash. It was a 30-year-old female. Her helmet was actually pulled from her head, and she basically went face first into a concrete abutment. And EMS had tried to intubate and failed due to too much blood in the airway. They were bagging the patient when she got to us. And that's the case. Patient who's pretty much massively exsanguinating from their mouth, and the source of the bleeding is somewhere in the mid-face, and you don't really know where. Now, obviously, as a resuscitationist, you know your first priority in these patients is to take the airway. Now, there's going to be blood in there, so you have to plan for that. So the way I'd plan for that, first of all, and this shouldn't even need to be said, but you got to be wearing personal protective equipment so you don't get splashed in the face. Then, since you already see there's blood in the airway, you're going to have to do a lot of suctioning. I would use two of the techniques in combination that we've discussed about before in the podcast. So first, I would create a suction-as-you-go ET tube setup, if you have the time, with a meconium aspirator and a bronch port. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, just come up to mcrit.org and go to this particular episode show notes, and you will find the link to that explaining how to set this up so that you'll be able to use your ET tube itself to suction out all the blood in the airway. At the same time, I would use Ruben Strayer's idea of, if you're going to use video laryngoscopy, and I'd strongly advise it in this case, you actually have your partners holding yank hours on either side of the patient and let them look at the screen and do the suctioning for you, so you could just keep that ET tube or bougie in your hand and not have to let go of the yank hour and pick it up and potentially lose your one glimpse of the glottis. Then the other thing we've discussed before is this case is definitively a Cricon 3 for the Cricon readiness posture, meaning that as I'm starting this airway, I already have another friend, another co-attending, one of the surgeons, prepping the neck, injecting, opening up the kit, and having the scalpel in their hand ready to go in case we run into any difficulties. If we can't get the initial endotracheal intubation, we try 1 to 2 more times max, and there's just too much blood, I would immediately at this point place a supraglottic airway. Now, my preference in these cases is a laryngeal mask type airway that allows intubation through it. Now, you might say, well, there's a ton of blood in the mouth. I can't place a supraglottic airway. You absolutely can. And the laryngeal mask type airways will actually shield the glottis from the blood for the most part and both allow you to oxygenate and potentially, if you have any form of fiber optics, whether it be a Levitan scope, a Bonfi like we have, or a straight up bronchoscope, it'll allow you to shield the glottis enough to be able to get a great view of the cords and intubate through the supraglottic airway. And that's why it's my preference to use those devices as opposed to something like a King LT, these extraglottic airways that, while they'll do the job, don't really provide a conduit for definitive airway management. Now, if you do these and you can't actually place the tube, you don't have fiber optics, what have you, I don't think there's any real shame in this point in just progressing to a cricothyrotomy. I have a lower threshold in these patients if their oxygen sats starting to decline and my initial airway algorithm's not working to progress to cricothyrotomy. Now, in the case at Janus General, we actually were able to visualize the glottis on our first pass of our CMAC video laryngoscope, and we were able to intubate the patient. So all our prep led to us not having to use it, which is the way it often happens. If you don't prepare, it goes to crap. If you do prepare, you never have to use it, and that's just good logistics. So now you have the airway controlled. What's next? Well, if you've identified the source of the bleeding as being somewhere from the midface, as opposed to a oral laceration, you know, a piece of bone sticking out of the mandible into the mouth, if you've been able to visualize that with good lighting, that it's not coming from the mouth, then you have to progress to packing. Now, I would start off trying anterior packing without too much hope in these massive midfacial hemorrhages that it's going to work, but you could give it a shot. I prefer strongly to have some form of commercial device. And my preference, and as you folks know, and I'll continue to reiterate, I take money from no commercial company at all. I have no bias in this regard. It's just I try a lot of things and I go with what I like. And what I like in these cases, I prefer the Rapid Rhino, not the one that has the built-in posterior anterior pack, just the straight up anterior pack Rapid Rhino, because it has both a balloon and the clot-forming dressing surrounding that balloon. I think these are really the ideal for these trauma cases. You could get away with a lot of stuff for just anterior packing for epistaxis, but for these bad traumas, this is my preference with no bias except that I like it. And so you'll put bilateral anterior packs of whatever type you have. If you are using the Rapid Rhinos, you soak them in some saline for 20, 30 seconds, and then you just pop them in. We have the 5 millimeter, or might be 5.5 millimeter ones, and then you inflate the balloon until there's a reasonable amount of pressure in the pilot balloon. And you then look in the mouth, and you're going to be looking in the mouth a lot. I prefer to continue with the video laryngoscopy, so I don't give to the sterilization pathway the blade I use to intubate these patients. I keep it around for the entire duration of the case because I'm going to have to keep going into their mouths and looking. And with the video, the light is so bright and I get to look at the screen. It's really nice. If you don't have that, you'll just use a standard laryngoscope and pop in there, suction out whatever was in the mouth, and then see if they're still bleeding, if they're still trickling down from the nasopharynx. And if they are, you have to go further. Now, obviously, during all this, you are going to be doing hemostatic resuscitation. You're going to be getting FFP. You're going to be getting blood if they need actual resuscitation in terms of their hemoglobin or their blood pressure. And you're going to, you know, maximize cryo, platelets, et cetera, just like you would for any standard resuscitation where there's been a massive amount of bleeding. At this point, if these initial measures had failed, if you haven't already, it's a good time now to put out a stat page to whoever's covering your midfacial trauma. This might be ear, nose, and throat. It might be plastic surgery. It might be OMFS. Depending on your institution, they might all rotate. It doesn't matter. Get someone down here because you're going to want some help. It's also a good time to look for oral fractures that may be contributing to the massive bleeding. If there's a split in the palate, that needs to be reduced temporarily with some form of fixation, usually wires across both sides of the maxillary teeth to bring the sides of the palates together. Otherwise, most of these other maneuvers are not going to work. And this is why you really want that midfacial surgical specialist there, someone who could take care of this stuff, someone who, if it progresses to that point, could decide whether they want to go to the operating room or angiography. So get those folks down. So what we've discussed so far is you've managed the airway, you've attempted anterior packing, and their questions come up, you know, what if they have a orbital fracture, you know, on the inferior portion of the orbit, can you still anteriorly pack? And these questions become more relevant when the patient's not all that sick, when they're massively hemorrhaging, they kind of fall out the window and you got to do what you got to do to keep them alive. So I think those questions fall by the wayside when you have a patient with massive hemorrhage. Okay, and we've mentioned if the palate is split, that needs to be reduced. You're not going to do that yourself. You need someone to help you on that one. And now we're going to progress, if the patient's still bleeding, to posterior packing. In patients with posterior epistaxis without trauma, you could use these commercial devices. Don't prefer them in the patient with blunt trauma midfacial bleeding. And the reason is that a lot of these patients will have concomitant fractures of their skull base, of their cribriform plate, and you don't want to wind up with these devices sticking into brain tissue. Now, you might say, oh, that's not going to happen. And surprisingly, it can happen quite commonly. There's one article in the show notes using the Epistat devices, which are just a commercial device. And I'm sure the other commercial devices have similar problems. These devices aren't long enough to actually see where they're going before you confirm their placement. And so they're just long enough to stick through a basal or skull fracture into a bad place, and you'll have no idea. The Foleys, on the other hand, you actually could advance and see go into the pharynx before you consider them well-placed, before you actually do the inflation. So let's actually walk through the steps of placing one of these posterior packs so you can get an idea, and then you'll know what I'm talking about. So you want to grab two Foley catheters. Now, in the ideal world, they'd be something a little bit thinner than normal, like 12 to 14 French. I never wind up having those, so we just use 16s, and those fit most adults. But if you have the smaller ones, that's nice. And what you want to do is you want to lube the hell out of them. If you have that, some form of lube antibiotic, that's good practice, good style points, but I never have them. I just use the Surgi lube, and I lube the hell out of these things. Now, you want to have a laryngoscope for this, and what you want to do is, you know, pick whichever nostril you want to start with. It doesn't really matter, and this is assuming the patient is already being intubated, because this is going to be kind of a clusterfuck if they're not. And you'll pass the Foley, obviously parallel to the floor of the nose, not pointing towards the brain, you know, straight back. And what you actually want to see is with the laryngoscope, you want to see them pass into the pharynx. And that's going to tell you they're not passing into brain tissue. And if you're meeting any resistance or you pushed a reasonable amount, you know, like greater than 8-9 centimeters, and you're not seeing them in the posterior pharynx, then pull back and try again. But what you want to see is you want to see the balloon appear in the back of the throat. And you could do one or you could do both at this point, and then you can inflate them after you've passed them both in the pharynx. Either way is fine. But what you want to do is you want to see each one going to the pharynx. This is the key portion of this technique in a patient with blunt mid-face trauma, because you don't want to wind up in the brain. You don't want to have that CT scan they show at all the grand rounds. So let's assume we did one, we saw it pass into the pharynx. What you want to do now, and this is the little tidbit that if you don't know this, you're going to screw this up, is you don't want to fully inflate the Foley balloon now. You want to put between 6 and 8 cc's of sterile saline into the Foley, not the 20 cc's you might have been told is how much you should use to inflate. So you put 6 to 8 cc's into the Foley balloon, and now you apply traction. Now, what this is going to do is if the balloon was fully inflated with like 20, 25 cc's, it's actually never going to wedge into the spot you want for maximal tamponade of the bleeding. It's going to stay in the nasopharynx. You don't want that. When you put 6 to 8 cc's in there, it's going to actually wedge into the posterior coana and actually allow it to sit properly. So you put the 6 cc's in there, and then you pull back until it stops, and you apply just a tiny bit more pressure than the stop point. And then at that point, I will put in another 12 to 14 mLs of the saline. So you're actually wedging it first and then fully inflating the balloon. Now, in posterior epistaxis, the patient's not intubated. It's super painful to put the 20 mLs in if you don't need it. So you do a graduated technique. You do that 6 mLs, then you do a little bit more and then a little bit more. In the massive midfacial trauma patient who's dying, who's intubated, you don't worry about that. You put in the 6 or 8, you pull back, and then once it's wedged, it fully inflate till the 20. If they're still bleeding, you could even go a little bit more, maybe 25. That would be probably my max, but I usually stop at 20. And that's the way you do it. So you've done one. Now you do the second one if you haven't already. Now you got two of them in there. Now you have to apply some continuous gentle traction, just like you would with the Blakemore. And I secure this in the traction the same way as do is in the Blakemore. So if you haven't seen what I'm talking about, go to my Blakemore video. I link to it in the show notes. And you'll see I just have an endotracheal tube securing device that I secure my ET tube with. And I just add on another little rail that allows me to gently pull. It's probably something like a half a kilo worth of pressure. I don't know. I've not seen any actual quantitation of this. But that's probably what I would apply is 500 grams of pressure. So, you know, you eventually figure out what gentle traction is, but if you really needed to measure it, you could attach an IV bag to this bad boy, put it over the IV pole with 500 cc's of saline, whatever that does, that's where you'd secure it. And then I use that rail to lock in these two. I just stick two of them in one of these little devices, and it holds the traction, and then I could get rid of worrying about any IV pole with weights or what have you. If you don't have that, there's all these other ways of actually clamping it with protection of the nostrils so you don't cause pressure necrosis there. And these just seem unwieldy to me, so I go with what I like. If you search for how to secure a posterior packing Foley, you'll find a ton of other options, but you got to apply gentle traction to these is the take-home answer. Once you've done the posterior packs, you now have to repack anteriorly. So I just took those same rapid rhinos, put them in both nostrils and inflate, and now I have the Foley's packing posteriorly, and I have the rapid rhinos packing anteriorly. And then again, stick your laryngoscope in and look in the mouth and see if they're still bleeding. If they've stopped, then you're done. And you obviously want to admit these patients to an intensive care setting, you know, your trauma ICU, and they need to be followed by the facial trauma service to decide when they're going to try deflating these devices. Usually what you do is you deflate gradually and leave them in place and see, does the bleeding start up again? So if it does, you could actually reinflate right away. If they are still bleeding at this point, and now you've done your temporary fracture fixation in the result of palatal trauma, you've done your posterior packing, you've done your anterior packing, and they're still bleeding, they have one of two options. They could either go to the operating room for an open operation. These don't generally work out so great, according to my surgical colleagues, my trauma colleagues. They bleed like stink. It's very difficult to find the vessels. The preference, and the articles to support this are in the show notes, in these patients is probably to go to angiography, arteriography, and actually see if you can, if there's any vascular abnormalities as a result of the trauma, and then potential empiric or guided gel foaming or coiling of the internal maxillary arteries, if that's the source of the bleeding. Sometimes the ethmoids, but actually trying to find the location of the bleeding on angiography and actually stopping the bleeding without having to do an operation. And this can be very effective if they could find the source of the bleeding. So that's probably, in my mind, the algorithm. And I actually have an algorithm from a very good review article in the show notes. Airway management, try anterior packing. If it fails, take the anterior packs out, put in posterior packs. I prefer Foley's because they don't wind up in the brain. You know where they're going. Do the posterior packing, repack bilaterally, anteriorly. Fracture fixation, if that's one of the potential causes of this patient's bleeding, you need probably someone skilled at facial trauma management for that. And then progression to angiography if the patient continues to bleed, assuming you've reversed all their bleeding dyscrasias, you've done hemostatic resuscitation, and they're still bleeding. Now, there's two more things I'll add. First of all, there's an article I've read. I've never tried this myself, but in the Emergency Medicine Journal, the British Emergency Journal, there's an article on the McKesson oral props that actually just prop the mouth open, and they state, and there's just two case reports, there's no real study here, that this will put pressure on the internal maxillary artery and potentially slow the bleeding that way. And it's just propping the jaw wide open. I'm not sure if this is effective. If anyone has tried it, please put it in the show notes. It's another potential way of taking care of this that I've never had experience with. If this is effective, I imagine you could rig the same thing with some form of bite block on either side of the teeth, but I don't know. If anyone has experience, please talk about it in the comment section. The other thing is there was a recent article on the use of TXA for epistaxis. And I don't know if the bleeding we're talking about here is in any way going to be helped by TXA in these cases. I just want to put it out there that you could potentially soak your rapid rhino or whatever packing you use in a TXA mixture. And my friend Ryan Radecki did a nice little review on this, so I'll link to that in the show notes as well. All right, so that's all I got. That's the management of severe midfacial blunt trauma with severe hemorrhage. If you have any questions, put them in the show notes. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.